The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Over the weekend, 93 people were reported killed when Israeli forces opened fire on crowds of Palestinians trying to collect humanitarian aid in Gaza at two separate aid sites. The deaths came as Israel issued fresh evacuation orders in central Gaza, which the UN has said is another devastating blow to humanitarian efforts in the Strip. In a few moments, we're going to hear about what life is like on the ground in Gaza from an Irish physio who's just returned from there. But first, we're joined by Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
It does seem, I mean, the Israelis always dispute what is reported by the Gaza Health Ministry, but it does seem as if the Israelis are acting with complete impunity.
They seem to be. I think that's the only way you can read this. There is another aspect, though, and that is for the Israelis, although everything seems to be going very well and the war is sort of on their side, that is not the reality. They're actually having much difficulty, and they simply cannot defeat Hamas in what you might call the traditional way. In fact, there was a remarkable development in the last few days. A leading retired Israeli general from the Israeli Defense Forces said that, as far as one could tell, Hamas has regained its complete strength in terms of the number of people involved since the start of the war. In spite of thousands and thousands of losses, there's so many new recruits coming in that essentially the Israelis are not making headway in getting rid of Hamas. Mm. And they're also able to use many of the tunnels, many kilometers of tunnels. And this is one of the reasons why the Israelis here and there are suffering casualties. They've been involved in two quite serious ambushes in the last 3 or 4 weeks, each losing 5 or 6 soldiers. So I think, yes, the Israelis are determined to do whatever they want. They feel they can do it as long as they have Trump on their side, and this is where they're going. But it covers a reality in which the war actually is not winnable in the way they think it is winnable.
I mean, you talk about the numbers increasing for Hamas, getting back perhaps to some sort of strength, but people are people. What about weaponry? I mean, that's going to be an issue for Hamas going forward if they're going to rejoin the battle with Israel.
Yes, the weaponry, we simply don't know what they have. There's some indications that they still have many hundreds of rockets and missiles all hidden, that the Israelis did not succeed in finding everything by a very long shot. And Hamas, working partly underground, have been able to redevelop. Now, you're absolutely right, and they don't have the equipment. Israelis can do virtually what they want, it seems, but they're just not getting rid of Hamas. It's certainly true that the Israelis have the drones, they can sort of watch the whole area. But the other side of the coin is that you have tens of thousands of young people, mostly men, but not all men, who are absolutely angry and resentful at what is happening to them. And they see their fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, friends killed. They see children suffering hugely. What is it, 17,000 children killed so far? And essentially, I think we don't fully recognize just what impact that has. Some analysts warned this at the start of the war, that in fact what you were going to do was to produce an even stronger Hamas, at least in terms of the numbers of people who support it.
I mean, it was always predictable, I suppose, that the Israeli behavior, once they went down the road of disproportionate responses to October 7th, that they would become a recruiting sergeant for Hamas.
Yes, and this seems also to be extended through to the West Bank. I mean, we tend to get less information coming from the West Bank, but the problems there have been huge. And even in Israel itself, where you have nearly 2 million people who are Israeli passport holders, but are mainly Palestinian Arabs, they are finding themselves pushed in great difficulty routinely. You know, life is not easy for them, even though they have full citizenship rights. But certainly the West Bank as a whole, again, it's becoming almost kind of breeding ground for people who are really getting very desperate. Nothing like as bad as Gaza yet, but it's getting a little bit that way on occasions.
Now, at the beginning of this war, there were some voices raised claiming this was a proposed genocide by Israel. Those voices have become louder and more multiple, I suppose, where even Israelis are saying, hang on a second, what's going on here is unacceptable. Like some of the reservists have been outspoken and saying, this is unconscionable for us.
it's very interesting that it's the many of the reservists. I mean, one of the key people is Major General Itzhak Brik, and he's a retired general, very experienced. He was the ombudsman for ordinary service people for a while. He's commander of the IDF military colleges. He himself has said that, as far as he can see, Hamas, in terms of person power, okay, mainly manpower, if you wish, Hamas probably has a similar strength to the start of the war. And he's warning that Israel is actually making more problems for itself because, in a strict military sense, this war is probably not winnable. But he's a fairly lone voice in terms of military speaking out. But yes, you're right. There are plenty of indications that individual service people who've been experiencing the war are getting extremely resentful about this, I think, themselves. And one has to remember that Israel basically is a citizen army. Almost all the people are reservists. So there's not much of a standing force. And so it really intermingles with society. That, I think, is having an effect on public opinion.
Now, one of the things earlier in all of this, when those walkie-talkies went off in Lebanon, we were all kind of struck by the ingenious nature of Israeli technology. And even though what happened to individuals was appalling, the strategic result of that was quite phenomenal to disrupt the command and control structure of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And then we are told all the time that ordnance has gone astray, that people have made mistakes. It doesn't fit with that idea of military exactness and sophistication that Israel boasts about. Suddenly they hit the Catholic Church and are condemned by, without mentioning Israel by name, by Pope Leo for that destruction. I mean, that is, to me, is a misstep by Israel, more than the first, of course, but it is a misstep.
It seems to be a very serious misstep in that case. And certainly, I mean, their prowess on the technical side seems to have been extraordinary. But at the same time, it doesn't seem to be working fully. One has to remember that if you're concerned with trying to defeat an enemy that is deeply entrenched, can you do it any other way but except by clearing people out of the whole area? And that seems to be what's happening with this demand that the people in Deir al-Balah have got to move again. And, you know, very large numbers, I think it's about 90% of all Gazan citizens have been forced to move at least once, and some of them four or five times. Now, that does not sort of indicate a country which combines very high technical capabilities with the ability to use them in such a way as to achieve their effect. And the problem here, as always, is that Israel is not in a position to actually face up to what really needs to be done. And you will only get a lasting peace if there is some sort of justice coming in. But for the Israelis, particularly under Netanyahu, this is impossible. But as you say, there seems to be a change within Israel, and it's partly by the impact of what is happening in Gaza, reaching through to ordinary people. But opinion polls at the moment still show Israelis overwhelmingly want to get out of Gaza. And a large proportion, I don't know whether it's even up to half now, it may be, actually would like to see all the Palestinians essentially deported from Gaza. So it's a long way to go. But yes, there is a change happening. But as long as Netanyahu feels that he's got Trump behind him, I think he will continue.
It's extraordinary that in this very sophisticated military age, that the Israelis have had to resort to almost medieval tactics of, you know, depriving people of water, depriving people of food, of fuel, of medicine. I mean, that is medieval in its approach.
And particularly, really not letting formula through, you know, formula milk. This means that sort of babies whose mothers cannot feed them are basically being fed ordinary milk or something else. Actually singling out formula is an indication, I think, of where Israel has slipped, at least people within Israel, one mustn't say the whole of Israel, have slipped on this. And it really is. It really goes back to medieval times. One has to remember that, you know, Israel does have what is called the Dahiya Doctrine, and that is that if you cannot defeat an insurgency by ordinary counterinsurgency means, then you actually harm the people who are supporting it. In other words, you spread it wider in the hope that you are undermining the public support for the insurgency. That does not seem to be happening, or at least not at the level that the Israelis assumed.
And the final thing is more general, I suppose. The accusation for anyone who criticizes Israel's behavior in Gaza is that they are anti-Semitic. There's a counter-argument that by conflating those, by Netanyahu conflating that, anyone who criticizes his government is anti-Semitic, that he actually creates that conflation in the wider world.
That is the real worry, that in fact, I mean, there is evidence, I don't know what it's like in Ireland, there's evidence in Britain that there is an increase in anti-Semitic actions of different sorts. And nothing is like as bad as the problems that the Muslims are having, where it's far worse, but it is happening. And I think, in a sense, what he is doing is probably aiding the growth of anti-Semitism. And then he can point to the fact that we have anti-Semitism, so Israel has to fight for itself. So it's a very, very difficult, but frankly, rather a vicious circle.
Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University, thank you very much for joining us. Listening to that conversation is Rika Hayes, who is a physio who has returned from Gaza and who may well be able to get back in again to continue her wonderful work. Rika, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, first of all, will you explain your background and how you ended up in Gaza? Because it is not your first theatre of conflict.
No, I've been doing this for about 7 years now. I joined the International Committee of the Red Cross, and I've been deployed to Ukraine, Yemen, Iraq, North Korea. So I have been building up a bit of a repertoire of conflict zones as is. But Gaza is a different level entirely. We have a 60-bedded field hospital that is based in Rafah, and we're running two surgical units there, and we've been dealing with the conflict there since its onset, really. The field hospital has been running since last year, May, but and we never thought it would run this long.
Can you describe the field hospital? I mean, how is it constructed? Is it simply tents?
Yeah, simply tents. It's just at the edge of Rafah before it comes on the Masi. It's by the coast. It's got... Well, initially it was a 60-bedded hospital with two surgical units, outpatient department, emergency department. But really, since the end of May, we've had such a massive influx of mass casualties that we've had to try and expand the number of beds we've had. When I left on the 24th of June, there was 119 patients. We ran out of beds. We had them on camper beds. Then we ran out of camper beds and we had them on stretchers. We were inching closer and closer to the ground now, but... Yeah, it's just the nature of the conflict has changed significantly, really, in recent months.
What is the nature of your work? What precisely can you do, do you do?
Well, I'd be a physiotherapist. So really, the kind of injuries you would see in the conflict zones are quite eclectic. So predominantly fractures as well, obviously open wounds, acquired brain injuries, burns, amputations. So really, you'd want to have a fairly solid background in all of those because that's precisely what we're seeing on the wards. We've got two surgical teams, and any kind of surgery that you have for any fractures or any wounds really should be followed up by physio to get people out of bed as soon as possible and get them mobilizing so that essentially they can be discharged and create space for new beds and new patients. So, and we do a lot of fracture management as well. So it would be the physiotherapist in the field hospital that puts on casts for fractures. Now, traction for femur fractures.
In other conflicts, perhaps less in modern times than maybe in the 20th century, a hospital was sacrosanct. It would not be targeted. How secure is your field hospital near Rafah?
I think you've heard it before, but no place is safe in Gaza. I mean, there's no discernible front line at all. It's besieged from all sides. And you would think, or as a patient arriving into a hospital, you are now safe. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Now, let's be fair, we're not. We don't believe we're targeted. But that doesn't mean we are safe from stray bullets, which has gone up significantly in the last few months. We have safe rooms, and we've tried to construct with what material we have, like walls on the south face of each tent. But even so, every single ward has had bullets in it. My physio tent had a bullet. My bedroom window had a bullet in it. Our office has been hit. We had a boy, a 13-year-old boy. He was waiting to be seen by a doctor in the outpatient department. He was hit by a bullet in the head and unfortunately died earlier this month. On the 17th of June, we had a lady. She was coming to visit an injured relative, and she was shot in the abdomen and her gait. And even at the beginning of this month, on the 4th of July, one of our tech guys, he was working on the generator and a stray bullet comes in through the tent and hits him in the chest. I mean, he's okay. He survived. He was lucky. But it's not safe. We can try and mitigate the harms as much as you can, but at the end of the day, we're made of canvas.
Yeah. It seems, you know, an awful lot of random stray bullets. The suspicion would be, of course, that this is quite deliberate by rogue elements who are determined to create, I suppose, chaos and a feeling of insecurity to stop you doing your work.
No, we generally don't believe we're being targeted. But the problem is when you fire bullets, particularly warning shots over a crowd, they do land. And this is what we're finding. They do travel, depending on the caliber of the bullets, they can travel 500 meters or even a kilometer. So obviously there's been a lot of shooting at the sites of distribution, food distribution sites. Three of them are in Rafah. We're the only hospital in Rafah. So when these are fired, and we're getting mass casualties and we're getting really busy, is also the time when the stray bullets are flying overhead. And it's not just us, it's obviously in the area around us. People are living in tents. We've had, when I left, there's at least two young girls. They were hit in the abdomen while they were in their tent. I've had a man in ED. He was in the middle of praying. He was shot in the arm, fractured humerus. I mean, bullets land eventually, you know, even if they're not directed at someone.
As you say, a warning shot fired over the heads of people, maybe 20 feet over the heads of people who are trying to get humanitarian aid, and warning shots from the Israelis, and that bullet may travel a kilometre, and it will, as you say, land somewhere.
Yeah. And again, it would not just be the Israelis. It can be any side. It can also be local families having fights. We've had those bullets hitting our building as well. Majority are coming from the south, all right, but I mean, they're coming from all sides. And it's just unpredictable. By the time you hear a bullet landing and you're calling for everyone to hit the floor, a safe area, it is kind of already too late.
Yeah. And the preparation, I mean, you mentioned other theatres of war where you have served with the International Committee of the Red Cross. Some sort of preparation for what you have discovered in your work in Gaza, but you say it's very different in Gaza. The intensity,
like I said, everywhere's a front line in Gaza. It's such a small strip of land that normally when I'm based and working in a hospital, I'm away from the front lines. You know, there's a relative calm where I'm living. And it doesn't quite, and a conflict that I normally live in a larger country, the whole country isn't suffering to the same extent of Gaza. In Gaza, the patients and the staff, there's not much that distinguishes between them other than an injury. So they're all going hungry. They're all displaced. Some of them, the last caller on, I mean, he said they've been displaced one or two times. We've had some staff displaced 16 times. And as mentioned, a lot of them are now living in Deir al-Bala. So cue frantic calls now for what they should do, where they should go. I mean, they're instructed often to go to Onawasi, but I've heard it before when Onawasi is the location where people are supposed to evacuate to. But then I'll hear 3 hours later, Onawasi will get hit and will receive mass casualty. So it's the hunger really that gets me, actually. And it's been quite insidious. It started off small with like meat and eggs that they didn't have. But like by the time I left, they were just eating rice, no vegetables. And food is medicine in itself. So
It's heartbreaking. And whatever about the resilience of adults who may be suffering privation, not enough food, not enough nutrition. When you see children who've been shot and they don't have enough just to even attempt to make a recovery, that's heartbreaking.
That is very, very hard on the team. But we have an excellent mental health and psychosocial support team that do really interact with them. But you'll see in the first couple of weeks that they're in, they're just staring vacantly at the ceiling. I mean, some of them have obviously lost family members, and others are just in shock that they've been hit in a place they thought was safe inside a tent. But we're just seeing more and more of it, you know. I mean, the lucky ones are the ones that are so young, they don't realise what's happening. I mean, the youngest was 6 months old. He doesn't know that his uncle who was holding him was killed in the same explosion that injured him. But like, we've also had a member of our staff, Reem. She worked in the FEMA ward, in the pediatric ward. And she went home one day and her tent was hit. And she was admitted to the same ward where she was working in. Her 8-year-old son was killed in the explosion. And her 9-month-old baby, who was born in our hospital, he's also admitted in the pediatric ward with injuries. So, and that's even harder for staff because they know them, you know.
Now, for the staff,
it's all around suffering.
You know, volunteers like yourself and others who are local to the conflict in Gaza, you know, people from the Gaza Strip itself who are working, the prospect of being able to continue to work, because I suggest that post-traumatic stress disorder is not something unknown to you and your colleagues.
Yeah, and again, the mental health teams are always supported, even during and after, to look in. But honestly, when I speak to my Gazan colleagues, even when I'm there present with them, they're just saying they don't have time to process. They don't have time to grieve at all. They're just trying to survive day to day and keep their family alive. But they're exhausted. It's 20 months of displacement, losing friends and family. Again, being hungry, and we're short on everything. This conflict is very much characterized by a shortage in fuel and food and medication. I mean, walking aids. I haven't had walking aids come in since December 2023. We have a carpenter who's sawing us crates to make crutches so I can give something to a patient.
Yeah.
But that's like the smallest issue. You know, we're running out of basic medication. I mean, there's also widespread scabies, you know, infectious diseases that are spreading because people are living in small tents. They can't clean.
Yeah.
We're running out of that. We can't get supplies in. And this is the greatest frustration. And remember, like, people don't stop having cancer and stroke and kidney failure during a conflict. They just stop having access to a service. And they get put aside because the acute injuries are prioritized. But people are still having strokes and they're not being seen.
Just some news coming in. The charity Medical Aid for Palestinians says a ground invasion has begun in central Gaza. It says that troops have entered the city of Deir al-Balah, and it warns it endangers humanitarian and healthcare sites. Israeli sources have told Reuters they believe that some hostages are being held there, and I presume that is their justification. So more horrors unfolding for the people of Gaza. You are due to go back in August, Rijke. Will you be able to get back? Do you want to get back?
I'm not sure I'll be able to return. It's just the security situation has been getting much worse. Like I mentioned, staff are starting to get hit by stray bullets in the hospital. The number of stray bullets coming in were increasing. Anyway, when I left, some days we were in a safe room 8 times during the day. And of course, you're super busy as well, but you have to put safety first. So right now, there's a potential that they'll be reducing the number of international staff going in. As regards to wanting to return, I would, yeah, because, I mean, you're there to support your colleagues. I mean, I have massive, like, profound respect and admiration for my Gazan colleagues. They are really phenomenal. I would happily have my family members treated by all of them. And they are tired. And just by being there and giving some support, it feels like it's not enough, but it's something. And so to know that I'm potentially not going back and seeing my team again, I'm struggling with that, if I'm being honest.
All right. Rijke Hayes, thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.